for Monday, April 23rd. And shall I open up both House bills? Open up a public hearing on House Bill 5022 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 5023.
Madam Chair? Certainly. We start today with the Department of Environmental Quality, and we have the director, and she'll start with the agency overview.
Great. Good morning. Maybe this is Mr. Chair now. There he is. I knew if I hit the gavel, he'd be coming soon. Just getting started.
You've opened up.
Morning.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck. I'm the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and seated next to me is Lisa Pearson from the Department of Administrative Services. You should have a white binder, which is our presentation today, and then, of course, you have our full budget in a black binder. I will be referring to materials in this white binder. In the inside pocket, there is a little brochure, which is a copy of our strategic directions. There is also a one-page color sheet, which summarizes all of our bills and our policy packages as they appear in the governor's recommended budget. And then there's a one-page black and white sheet that reflects the amendments that the co-chairs have made to those policy packages. What I'm going to do today is give you a summary of our budget, and then we'll move on to performance measures, and then we'll go through our policy packages in each of our programs, and I will close with a few remarks about program priority list and 10% reduction list that are in the binder. Also, at the very last tab of the binder were the materials that we presented to you in the agency overview in January, if you need to refer back to those. So I'm going to start at tab A, the agency summary. So if you would turn to that, the first page is a pie chart showing the governor's recommended 07-09 operating budget of $194 million for DEQ programs. The operating budget supports our core program activities, our permitting, compliance, technical assistance, rulemaking, that sort of thing. Our total budget is about $300 million, and that includes pass-through dollars, the debt service, and I'm not going to really be talking about that. The operating budget is, if you will, the meat and potatoes of where our general, federal, lottery, and other funds are, and all of our staffing. If you turn to page 2 in the binder, this bar chart shows the DEQ operating budget over time by fund type. The red is the general fund. The blue, which you see we have a small amount, is lottery. Green is other funds, which is primarily fees, and yellow is the federal funds. This chart shows that for the past three biennia, starting in 01-03 and in up to the current 05-07, our operating budget has been relatively flat. It also shows that if we receive no new resources in 07-09, if we didn't get either the governor's budget or the co-chair's budget, we will see a significant drop between our current operating budget of $174 million and what we can actually continue to fund in 07-09 without new resources. And that figure is the $165 million shown in the bar labeled 07-09 modified essential budget level. So I show that to you just so you can see that it is critical for us to have some new resources either through the governor's budget or the co-chair's budget. The decline in our budget is due to past general fund cuts, loss of federal funds, and increasing reliance on fees which do not keep up with inflation and the cost of doing business. The red portion of the bar for 05-07 legislatively approved budget shows our general fund currently at $18.3 million. The governor increases that by $16.4 million to a total of $34.7 million shown in red in the bar marked 07-09 governor's recommended. The co-chairs increase the $18.3 million by $11.3 million to a total of $29.6 million shown in red in the last column on the right marked 07-09 co-chairs. And then if you wanted to refer to the black and white sheet in the pocket of the binder, you'll see that the co-chairs cut a total of $5.7 million general fund from the governor's budget for DEQ and also do not fund a bond sale for cleaning up orphan sites that would be $4.8 million in the coming biennium. And the co-chair cuts basically affect the core air quality program and two policy packages there, protecting air quality in the Columbia Gorge, the governor's clean diesel initiative, water toxics monitoring, stormwater control, business and workforce accountability, and the bond sale, as I said earlier, along with the general fund in packages that are needed to service the debt for that bond sale. In addition to the cuts made by the co-chairs, the $5.7 million, there are two general fund items which were in the agency request but are not included in the governor's budget or the co-chair's budget. The governor's office has agreed that we should bring these to your attention. Now, there's no handout on this, but I'll briefly describe them. One is $805,000 of general fund and 3.25 FTE to support the federally delegated hazardous waste compliance program. The other is a little over $1 million and 5.5 FTE in the water program to fulfill the federally delegated responsibility to set water quality standards. Without this funding, we will be having conversations with stakeholders and with EPA about our ability to continue to fulfill our federal obligations in the hazardous waste and the water programs. Again, those are two items that were not included in the governor's budget or the co-chair's budget. So to summarize, there is a total general fund need of $7.1 million for DEQ that is not included in either the governor's or the co-chair's budget, plus a $4.8 million bond sale for the coming biennium, which is not included in the co-chair's budget. Seven existing staff in the air program and four existing staff in the hazardous waste program are at risk without those funds. And then I will move on to the bar chart on page 3. This shows the trend in DEQ staffing by program. In the current 05-07 biennium, we have 777 FTE, which will drop to 687 FTE with no new resources. Overall, the chart shows that between 01-03 and 05-07, our programs have been shrinking and will continue to do so without new resources. For example, water quality staffing, which is shown in light yellow, reached a high of 235 FTE in 01-03. It's currently at 201 FTE and would drop to 193 FTE with no new resources. Loss of resources in water has meant that we have permit backlogs and reduced capacity to do compliance inspections. We have more than a 50% reduction in our monitoring sites for the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds and a 25% reduction in monitoring sites for total maximum daily loads, or as we prefer to call them, the clean water plans. And we also currently have an inadequate stormwater program. And we will be talking more about the performance implications when we get into the performance measure discussion, but I just wanted to give you a snapshot of the impacts of losing those positions. In the air program, which is the purple with the white dots, we dropped from 126 FTE in 01-03 to 107 FTE in the current biennium, and we will drop to 93 FTE with no new resources. Because of staffing reductions, for the first time we have permit backlogs in the air program. Also in air, we have had to discontinue air quality monitoring at 12 sites and reduce sampling frequency at our remaining sites. In the land quality program, which is shown in light blue, we will drop from 240 FTE in the current 05-07 biennium to 213 FTE in 07-09 with no new resources. We have had to cut staff over time in cleanup because of a drop in revenue from cost recovery and from the hazardous waste disposal site in Arlington. I already mentioned the cuts in general fund to our federally delegated hazardous waste program and the importance of the bond sale for cleanup of orphan sites. We also have four fee bills this session to support resources in land quality. And speaking of fees, I would like to talk now about the fee-funded portion of our budget. operating budget. If you turn to page 4, the green shows that other funds, which are mostly fees, account for 66% of our budget in the current biennium. By way of comparison, when I came to DEQ 18 and a half years ago, our budget was split roughly a third, a third, a third between general, federal, and other funds. And those proportions represented an investment in protecting public health and the environment that was equally shared by the citizens of Oregon who contribute to pollution, but who also demand that pollution be prohibited, controlled, or cleaned up, by the federal government through EPA to carry out congressional mandates delegated to states, and by business and municipal entities subject to state and federal regulation of the pollution they generate. As these pie charts illustrate, the funding burden has shifted dramatically to those who are regulated and who pay fees. DEQ is requesting fee increases in many of our programs, as you can see from the list of bills and policy packages in the pocket of the binder. The governor's budget and the co-chair's budget include all of those fee increases. This means that our budget will continue to rely heavily on fees in 07-09, as you can see from this pie chart. And we recognize that given the demands for general fund and the continuing disinvestment by the federal government in states, funding from fees paid by the regulated community is likely to remain a reality. However, a heavily fee-dependent budget does have problems. Most fees are not indexed for inflation, as I mentioned earlier, and even when they are, the consumer price index has not been sufficient to keep up with personnel and healthcare costs, which means we are always running behind and continually seeking fee increases. From a workload and a performance perspective, the agency spends an enormous amount of time negotiating funding with fee payers and other stakeholders, going through rulemaking with our commission and getting legislative approval for fee bills, time which could be spent doing environmental work. And some would argue that the control of funding gives fee payers an unfair advantage in influencing environmental policy. Fee increases also have an impact on Oregon's economy and ratepayers, and fee payers are reaching saturation. For the first time in my recollection, we came into session without support from large industrial fee payers for an increase in fees in one of our most important programs, federal air permitting. As a result of some very hard work by Andy Ginsberg of my staff, we have reached agreement on modifications to Senate Bill 107, which will be before this committee, which we hope will result in legislative support for the air fee increase in this bill. A not-so-obvious problem with fee funding is that most pollution in Oregon comes from urban and rural runoff, from automobiles and other small engines, and from activities people throughout Oregon do every day. With few exceptions, notably the vehicle inspection program and the septic program, where individuals pay fees, general and federal funds typically support DEQ's work to address these area-wide smaller sources of pollution. As we have lost federal fund and general fund, our ability to address many small sources of pollution in Oregon has diminished. Also, as general fund is removed from our budget, technical assistance is one of the first activities to be cut because fees and federal funds typically do not cover this service. Complying with environmental regulations is especially hard on small businesses in small communities without technical assistance. Finally, the very small portion of general fund, less than 2%, the state invests in natural resources and environmental protection, sends a message that Oregon does not care about protecting the natural environment of our state. Of course, it is important to provide an education for our children and to ensure the health, safety, and economic well-being of our citizens. But I submit that it is equally important to ensure that our children grow up with clean air and clean water in an environment that is safe from toxic substances. To do that, more general funds should be allocated to natural resource agencies overall. So I will stop there for a moment and see if there are any questions before I go on to page 5.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Clark.
There was a figure you quoted, I think it was 7.7 million that was insufficient in both the governor's and the co-chair's budget, and I didn't catch what that was for, what that was related
okay.
to.
First of all, $5.7 million of it reflects cuts that the co-chairs have made from the governor's recommended budget. And those cuts are shown on this black and white sheet of paper in the front of your binder. and that summarizes the $5.7 million general fund that the co-chairs reduced from the governor's rec. And there's also a bond sale of $4.8 million that they did not fund, or is in abeyance anyway. The rest of it, the difference between 5.7 and 7.1, are in two programs that the agency requested funding for, but the governor did not fund, and we discussed with the governor's office speaking to you about that. One is the hazardous waste program, and there are no sheets of paper that have this on it. The hazardous waste program is $805,000. That's federally delegated by EPA to the state. It's funded part federal, part general, and part fees, and the general fund portion was not included in the governor's budget. The other is the water quality standards. We had a new request in for a little over $1 million in general fund and 5.5 FTE to the governor. Water quality standards work is extremely controversial. As many of you know, this is where we do things like the temperature standard or the turbidity standard, water quality toxic standard. It is the foundation of the water quality program. We currently have two staff working on water quality standards. We are not meeting the Clean Water Act responsibilities that we need to meet under federal delegation. And so, as I said, we will be having a conversation with the federal government about whether or not we can continue to do the work, and also with the fee payers, if absent general fund, they're interested in paying more fees to help us do that work.
One thing in relation to the co-chair's recommendations, the first two POPs, 110 and 111, the meet federal air quality health standards and reduce health risks from toxics, air pollution. At the beginning of this budget process, there was a feeling that the governor in his budget had underestimated federal funds. And that's part of the reason the co-chairs believe that that they could reduce the amount of general fund dollars. That has kind of shifted now because of new information. And the expectation now is that the lower expectations for federal funds are probably more realistic. So we already recognize that we have an issue there, and the co-chairs already recognize that. Obviously, some of the rest of this, one of the biggest ones is the downscaling of the clean diesel program in terms of accounting for the actual cuts. The co-chairs generally have not approved very much in COP funding, so that's pretty consistent, actually.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that question, Representative Clem. And we will talk much more about the program impacts of these later on, so I'm not going to dwell on them right now, but there are significant program impacts from some of these reductions. If there are no further questions on this part, I would turn to page 5 in tab A and talk about some of the budget drivers that we considered in putting together our budget. Our legislation and our policy packages will help us, we hope, meet these challenges, and they're, of course, reflected in our strategic priorities for the agency. And I'm just going to cover a few of the highlights. The programs will talk more about this later. The first on the list is to protect people and the environment from toxics in our air, water, and land. We have cleanup issues, as I've discussed. We also need to continually deal with pollution from new sources and control pollution from existing sources. And the bond sale, of course, is critical in terms of cleaning up the sites, the orphan sites for which there is no source of funding for cleanup. Reducing and controlling pollution of our surface water and our groundwater is the second item on the list. The governor's budget supports our water permitting program and provides a fully funded program to regulate stormwater runoff, which is a significant source of pollution to rivers and streams. Groundwater, however, has not fared so well over time. Because of general fund cuts, DEQ's groundwater program resources have been almost completely eradicated. And I would just note, I think that protection of groundwater is an issue that the state needs to come to terms with as a whole in the future as we look at our supplies of water and clean water. Maintaining clean air is the third item on the list. Oregon communities have done a great job of meeting federal air quality standards. Our air is far cleaner than it used to be. Our ambient air is. Now we face new challenges from air toxics such as benzene and mercury, as well as tighter federal standards for some pollutants, particulate matter, and we understand there may be new ozone standards coming down the line as well. And, of course, we always battle growing pollution as our population grows. The co-chair's cuts, as Senator Devlin just referred to the air program, would directly affect our ability to monitor and regulate the ambient air pollutants and the toxic air pollutants. The fourth issue is controlling emissions that contribute to climate change. Under Governor Kulongoski, Oregon has been a leader in reducing pollution from cars and trucks and in promoting alternative energy sources and reducing our reliance on fossil fuels. DEQ is currently implementing Oregon's low-emission vehicle standards passed by the Environmental Quality Commission, and our budget this session includes the governor's clean diesel initiative to further reduce vehicle emissions. I alluded to some of the issues around keeping state primacy and federal programs, which is the next item on the list. Many years ago, Oregon decided to take delegation of environmental regulation from US EPA. As I mentioned earlier, we are requesting several fee increases this session, and the primary reason fee payers are willing to support fee increases is to keep the state running federal programs. However, as I also mentioned earlier, because of lack of general fund for the hazardous waste program and to develop water quality standards, we will be having conversations with EPA and stakeholders about what is needed to retain primacy in those programs. And we may have some of those conversations around the air program, depending on what happens with the co-chair's budget. Monitoring the condition of the environment. Monitoring is far more than just a way to tell whether facilities are complying with permits. It provides the foundation for key policy decisions about the environment. Monitoring can be, if adequately funded, the core of our ability to measure change in the environment and impacts on public health, and to tell if the work that we do is effective. The governor's budget supports monitoring in both the air and water programs. Communicating information about the environment is the next key environmental challenge. The public has an expectation and a right to information about pollution that affects their health and the environment. We must continue and expand efforts like the Environmental Information Exchange Network, which is a federally funded package in our budget, and I will describe it more to you later on. And then finally, modernizing systems to increase efficiency and improve service to the public. Budget cuts have eroded infrastructure throughout state government, and DEQ is no exception. Our policy package for business and workforce accountability helps restore that infrastructure and also to focus on process improvements. Are there any questions on those key budget drivers?
Any questions?
Okay, moving to page 6. The last point that I'd like to make in this overview is shown on page 6. And what these statistics show is that DEQ, like many agencies, is a workforce in flux. We are losing our baby boomers, and budget constraints have limited our ability to hire. Most jobs at DEQ require technical expertise, advanced education, experience, or all three. Simply put, state salaries are not adequate to recruit and retain qualified staff. We have always competed with the federal government, the private sector, and consulting firms, and now find ourselves increasingly losing employees to municipal government. Fortunately, the DEQ mission is attractive to younger workers, so they come to DEQ, but it is tough to keep them. Gen X and Gen Y have a set of work drivers that public sector bureaucracy has difficulty accommodating. We are also struggling to create a more diverse workforce that reflects an Oregon that is becoming, which looks different than the Oregon that was. This is a challenge being faced by all employers in Oregon. We must create a different culture in our organizations, one that is actively welcoming to employees of all backgrounds and all ages. The state needs to follow the lead of PGE, Nike, TriMet, and others with proactive initiatives to recruit, support, and maintain a diverse workforce. Finally, if the state is to successfully recruit the workforce of the future, we have to overhaul our classification and recruitment strategies, training, and mentoring, and we must either increase pay scales overall or provide maximum flexibility in salary offers, maximum flexibility in work schedules, and other incentives. The governor's budget provides two positions to DEQ to help recruit and train the workforce of the future. The co-chair's budget funds one of those positions. And that concludes my overview remarks. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. And if there aren't any, I will invite one of my staff to the table for the performance measure discussion.
Yes.
Very concerned. I didn't know there was a Gen Y already.
Senator Vakian, there is indeed a Gen Y.
So, would Representative Klein be a Gen Xer? Would he be an Xer?
I would not presume to guess Representative Klein's age.
I think I'm in the X.
Are you? We probably have a Gen Y.
There's one past that, actually, Mr. Chair. I forget what it's called. Millennium? Something or other. People born after 2000.
And so, Mr. Chair, we're like a Gen M or something.
Boomers.
Boomers.
Senator Courtney must be like a Gen K or L.
I think we're boomers anyway. We're
Gen
Y. I'm
not a boomer at all.
Talk about this, forget the term you used, but the Gen X and Gen Y, their expectations are different than what we've got in terms of, is it, you know, flex time and 8-to-5 work days and non-telecommuting, or what is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, it is all the above. Coming to work, it's very interesting. We've been doing a lot of, since DEQ headquarters is located in Portland, I feel like we have sort of a unique opportunity in terms of the workforce we can attract. So we have been doing a lot of research into this, and they have a completely different outlook on what it means to go to work. What it means to go to work is, when I work for you, I am there for you 110%. I will give you my all. I will work hard. I am your person, and I will be there as long as you're doing something for me. And that means either you are giving me authority and responsibility quickly, you are giving me lots of electronic tools to work with, you are accommodating my family and my whatever my time needs are, whether it's telecommuting. Money gets me in the door. Money does not necessarily keep me there. It's these other things that keep me there. So it is very different. And it's obviously there are pluses and minuses, because you get bright, enthusiastic, energetic, willing to work young people, but the pace is like this, and they want personal attention. One of the things I learned recently at a conference is, when you get them in the door, you connect them with someone right away in a mentoring type way. You include them in meetings. They are not the workforces that when you go to them and say, "You're doing great. In 5 more years, you're going to be right up there at the top of the ladder." I mean, they're going to be out the door in 3 months if they don't see that they are really contributing in a valuable way. And so our systems are playing a lot of catch-up. And not to mention, in addition to, when I say diversity, I'm just not talking about ethnic or racial or anything. I'm talking about age. I'm talking about everything. I mean, it's a different world. And it was really interesting to me at the last conference I went to, the speaker said that what has happened to the baby boomers and the other people who are in the workforce with these young people now, they're sort of looking at this ethic that they're bringing in, and they're going, I think I want a piece of that too. I think I'd like to have a more flexible schedule, and I'd like to be able to work at home more or whatever. So it's not that the value system of the older workforce is necessarily translating to the younger workforce. It goes both ways. So it's really, really interesting.
Not to go too far astray of our current topic, but in another committee we are seeing another aspect of this. And that is in the training of physicians. And the fact that we used to invest $200,000 train a physician, they would actually start practice by the time they got through their residency in their early 30s, and they would work till they're 65, 67. Now we're seeing that they want to start working part-time by the time they're in their 40s. They want to retire by their early 50s. and it's creating some real problems in terms of healthcare workforce. So. Not necessarily
born too late.
Well, I guess we will be going on to performance now.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would like to pull up another chair here, if I may, and invite Karen Whistler to the table to join me and Lisa. Karen is, this is tab B in your binder. Karen tracks all of our performance measures and works with our programs to produce the annual report in your binder. And she's going to walk through the key performance measures and explain the proposed changes. At the beginning of tab B, we've provided a listing of our performance measures tied to policy packages for quick reference. And the performance measures and the strategic priorities are also reflected in the little brochure in the pocket of your notebook. Development of strategic priorities and performance measures has been and will continue to be iterative, which is one of the main things I wanted to point out today. When I became the director of DEQ 6 years ago, the agency had not articulated a clear set of priorities, and our performance was driven primarily by the Oregon benchmarks and by the commitments we made to US EPA in order to receive our federal grant money. It took 2 years to formally adopt agency-wide strategic priorities and to develop key performance measures with stakeholder input and with the oversight by the Environmental Quality Commission. In 2004, we updated the priorities and measures. In 2006, we completed the 5-year priorities that are reflected in the brochure in your binder. And as you'll hear from Karen today, we continue to update and refine our performance measures. Our commission takes the strategic plan and the performance measures very seriously. We report to them twice a year, and last did so in February. And after session, they will have a retreat to review our budget and consider changes to our priorities and measures if appropriate. We've made great strides in establishing meaningful performance measures, but we're far from perfect, and we would be the first to admit it. We think the measures are good, and the links to our budget will be clear, and that the changes we propose will make them even better. And Karen, if you would, introduce yourself, and off we go.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. I'm Karen Whistler, and I'm DEQ's Performance Measurement Coordinator. And today I'm going to be walking you through DEQ's proposed 2007-09 key performance measures, which, as Stephanie pointed out, you'll find at tab B in the binder. And behind the key performance measures, there are a couple of additional materials. One is the 2005 annual performance progress report, and the other one is the 2007 customer service report. These are included for your reference, but I'm actually going to be just walking you through the key performance measures that start on page 3. So as I discuss our performance targets and the results for 2005, yes? Do you have a question?
Oh, no. I just wanted to let you know that we'll follow our normal pattern, and I'll have you go through two of the performance measures.
Great.
And then we'll take questions and then two more.
Great.
It's tended to work out relatively well, particularly with this minimal attendance as we have today.
So as I go through these key performance measures, I'm going to be providing the targets and the results from 2005, and if we have updated data for 2006, I will also share that with you. And then I'm going to be sharing with you our specific requests for modifying the wording or adding or deleting different key performance measures for the 07-09 biennium. So if you look at page 3 at tab B, it provides a list of our proposed 2007-09 performance measures, and there are 16 of them. And then if you turn the page to page 4, you'll notice that there are a number of measures that we're proposing to delete for this biennium. So starting at page 5, key performance measure number 1 is the newly rewarded measure of customer service. Yeah? Okay. Yeah. That's being used by all state agencies. It supports DEQ's priority of delivering outstanding public service by continuously seeking customer feedback. We met our 2006 target of 85% of our customers rating our service as good to excellent. This performance is considered by our survey consultant to be excellent in the public sector. Our survey included air quality and water quality permittees and on-site septic sewage homeowners. In the future, we will also track customer service perceptions from our vehicle inspection customers and hazardous waste technical assistance customers. Key performance measure number 2 on page 6 tracks timeliness in issuing air contaminant discharge permits, or ACDP permits, and is also an Oregon benchmark. It's benchmark number 10A. Businesses need quick turnaround times on permits to construct or expand their operations, and high percentages of permits issued in a timely manner is a key economic development indicator for the Oregon Progress Board. During the 1990s, DEQ worked to eliminate a large permit issuance backlog in the program, and by the beginning of this decade, we were issuing 90% of our ACDP permits in a timely manner. Our success was the result of extensive streamlining of permitting procedures and rules, which culminated in a complete overhaul of the program in 2001. Process efficiencies focused on reducing the need for permit modifications, eliminating bottlenecks in the process, and shifting about half of the facilities from individual permits to general permits, which can be issued much faster. This not only improved timeliness, but it also enabled us to shorten the target timeline from which to issue permits. However, beginning in 2002, we have seen a steady erosion of timeliness. Our 2005 results fell short of our target. 84% of these permits were issued within the timeliness target period, while our goal was 90%. These results are largely related to the fact that the number of positions budgeted in the air permitting program was reduced to a bare minimum, and we've been operating below budgeted staffing levels in anticipation of ongoing revenue shortfalls. Since 2001, the ACDP permit program has lost 7.5 FTE, or more than 20% of our workforce, to a current budgeted level of about 28 staff. Timely ACDP permits are a key requirement for many new and expanding businesses. With ongoing streamlining, we expect to be able to meet the 90% timeliness goal at the current budgeted staff level. The fee increase described in policy package number 114 is needed to fund the existing budgeted positions. So I'll stop for questions on those two measures.
One question I had, what is considered timeliness in this sense? What is the standard?
Timeliness for the air contaminant discharge permits? Well, it depends on the type of permit, and we have a number of different kinds of permits. So it varies from 1 month to a year, essentially, depending on what kind of permit it is, which is why we don't actually specify the timeliness target. We have new or renewal permits for large sources. We also have small sources. And then we have modifications, and each one of those has a different kind of target.
Not being entirely familiar with your permit process, mm-hmm. but would it be the normal that the clock would start running when you've received all materials that are necessary to process the permit?
Right, when we've received the completed permit application.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any additional? Please proceed.
Okay. Key performance measure number 3 on page 7 measures timeliness in issuing wastewater discharge permits and is also an Oregon benchmark. It's benchmark number 10B. We met our 2005 target for timeliness by focusing on individual permits and issuing permits on a watershed basis. The target was 40%, and we processed 42% of our permit applications within the target period. The water quality permit program is one of DEQ's top priorities. We have a budget proposal that will help us continue to work on being as efficient and effective in the water quality program as possible. This key performance measure, number 3, is about the amount of time it takes us to process a wastewater permit once the permit application has been received. The next measure, key performance measure number 4 on page 7, tells us how many permits are current, measured as a percentage of all wastewater permits. So turning to key performance measure number 4 on page 5, this measure tracks the percent of wastewater permits that are current. Maintaining up-to-date permits is important for several reasons. One, it assures that current technology is used to reduce water pollution. Two, it assures that the permit is appropriate given advances in our scientific understanding of the environment. And three, current permits reflect changes in the environmental conditions. This measure tracks all federal and state water permits, excluding permits for septic systems. At the end of 2006, 88% of all federal and state water permits were current. We have two policy packages that are related to this measure, Package 120 for our wastewater permit program and Package 122 for stormwater control. If these packages are not funded, we'll have a significant problem meeting the targets for this measure in the coming years due to ongoing litigation with stormwater permits, such as the industrial general permit for the Columbia Slough. Does anyone have any questions so far?
On KPM number 3, the permit timeliness for the NPDES permits, can you explain why the huge jump in targets for 06 and 07? Is that anticipated more funding, and so you'll be able to turn these around? Is that part of the Blue Ribbon Task Force implementation?
Actually, I'm not sure I can explain the change in target.
Can I ask you to address that?
I think, Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, that yes, in part, we are certainly hoping we will get our budget request, and the work that we have done with our stakeholders will provide more staff. And Lori Onan, who's the Water Administrator, may have something to add to that, if not.
Is there room for me?
Sure. Or just speak in for a moment.
Okay. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, Lori Onan, the Water Quality Administrator for DEQ, and I want to make sure I understand the question. So we're looking at...
I think it's about the targets that are for key performance measure number 3 on wastewater discharge permits, which went from 50% in 2006 to 70% in 2007, 8, and 9.
Okay, thank you. If that's the question, yes, we do have a focused effort to improve our wastewater permit program. We've been working on it since 2002, and Director Halleck made it a priority. We did get increased funding, both general fund and fees last session. We have more funding coming this session, we hope, in the co-chairs and governor's budget. And these targets were set because we think we can get better performance in turning our permits around more quickly. One thing I wanted to point out that Karen didn't cover in her talking points that's related to this, our customer service report that is part of this tab in the back of it talks about actual time to issue these permits. First of all, individual wastewater permits are extremely complex. There just a lot of technical and policy work that goes into them. However, between 2002 and 2006, the time that it took to process those dropped by 22%. In 2002, it took about 37 weeks, which is about 257 days, and 2006, it's down to 26 weeks, which is about 183 days. So we think that we can continue to get better, and there are some positions we're requesting in our policy package to help our permit writers do them even more quicker than that. So.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any additional questions? Seeing none. Please proceed.
Okay. Key performance measure number 5 on page 8. This measure measures the percent of impaired water bodies for which EPA has approved a total maximum daily load, or TMDL, which is also known as a clean water plan. DEQ monitoring has shown that where TMDLs have been developed and implemented, water quality is the most improved in the state. Some examples of this include the Columbia Slough, the Tualatin, Bear Creek, and Grand Ronde Rivers. The 2005 target is 41% of our actual result, and our actual result is 22% of impaired water body miles with an approved TMDL. We had planned to complete TMDLs for the Willamette and Umpqua basins in 2005, but those TMDLs are the largest and most complex that we've done and were not completed until 2006 and 2007. Those TMDLs have now been approved by EPA. Also, because we update the list of impaired water bodies approximately every 2 to 4 years, the baseline for this measure is constantly changing. For example, there are more than 13,000 river miles on the 2002 list of impaired waters and almost 15,000 river miles on the 2006 list. We've completed TMDLs for 39% of impaired water bodies miles in 2006. If the 2006 EPA-approved list of impaired waters is not updated over the next couple of years, and if our existing resources for the TMDL program do not change, we should be able to meet the 2008 target for this measure. However, the effects of current and potential future litigation in the water quality program could divert resources from the TMDL program or affect our ability to update the impaired waters list, which may affect our ability to meet future targets.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could just make a clarifying point there. The box on your chart for 2006, I think, is empty. You can write 39% in there.
Key performance measure number 6 on page 8 measures the percent of chemical agent destroyed at the Umatilla Chemical Agent Disposal Facility and is linked to our strategic priority of protecting human health and the environment from toxics. DEQ oversees the safe destruction of chemical weapons at the Umatilla Depot. The Army and their contractor are actually responsible for the actual destruction of the chemical agents, and they established the targets for this measure to fulfill international treaty obligations. Pursuant to the treaty, destruction of all chemical agents is to be completed by 2012. The Army is actually scheduled to complete munitions destruction by 2010. Incineration began in 2005. By the end of 2006, the Army had destroyed 23% of the chemical agents stored at the depot, which exceeded its target of 18%. The Army is well on its way to meeting the 2007 goal of 25%. Weapons destruction to date has reduced the overall risk to local residents by 88%. And I actually have an update. As of Thursday, April 19th, the Army's destroyed 931 tons of sarin, which brings the original stockpile reduced by 91.5%. No, wait a minute. That's 91.5% of the original stockpile of sarin, which is the most dangerous and most migratory of the toxins. And then it reduces the total stockpile by 25%.
I had a question going back to number 5.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some questions. Obviously, TMDLs are always can be controversial. There's been some question as to the authenticity of some TMDLs. A, is that true? B, if so, is it personal error, or is it that our measuring devices are not functioning?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, Stephanie Halleck, the issue, TMDLs are extraordinarily complex, and certainly in your part of the state, we've had one of the most complex total maximum daily loads there is in the Klamath Basin. I think the issues that have come up are really around whose science is the right science. And there are always different scientists who will look at issues in different ways. The Klamath is very complex. The Willamette is very complex. We've done a whole basin TMDL for the Willamette, so it's all the tributaries, all of the main stem. There's litigation on the Willamette as a result of that. We also in the Klamath have the a relationship with the state of California, and in some cases you have different standards in a different state. So there are a variety of reasons why people don't agree on the data. And there is not enough probably resources in the world to do all the monitoring than one might want to do if you want to base your information solely on monitoring. So you do some modeling, you do some research and studying of historical conditions, you weigh it all together, and then you make best professional judgments. And people do not always agree about those judgments. Sometimes they litigate. TMDLs, we've always tried to approach and are written, our water quality standards are written to be iterative, so that we know they will get revisited over time, because you'll always have new studies, you'll always have new data, and they're designed to be updated and to have permits get updated and changed to reflect those changing conditions. So it's by far from a perfect system. We are, as I think you know, almost all of you know, doing total maximum daily loads in the state right now under a consent order. So that we are on a court-ordered deadline to meet the requirements in there. And so far we're doing all right. But the more litigation there is, the more that slows that down. And I don't know if that really answers your question. There is no really direct answer.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Is this a budget item of concern, Ms. Halleck, in that are you going to need more money to do this?
in the future, because you've got, as complex as the Klamath Basin is, the Willamette and certain other areas are more complex. Is this a budget driver for you in the future?
Senator Devlin, Representative Girard, we do have a policy package for TMDLs. We are losing some federal money, and we have a policy package that would replace that with general fund, and that package, I believe, is included in both the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget. The related water quality packages, though, all of these activities are interrelated. So we have the water quality policy package for toxics monitoring. That has a package of $1.8 million in the governor's budget. The co-chairs cut $800,000 from that. That is a package that would provide additional data that could inform TMDLs, particularly in the Willamette. Water quality permitting, setting permit limits. When the TMDL changes, you have to update the permit. So there is an ongoing need for resources. If the governor's recommended budget is funded as requested, we should be all right in this program for being able to do what we need to do. Now, whether or not what we think we need to do is as fast as everyone thinks we need to do it, or as thorough as everyone thinks we need to do it, is a subject open to debate. But our budget needs would be fulfilled with the governor's recommended budget in this arena.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. That was the brightest statement you've made this morning from the standpoint of being overly depressive so far.
Thank you, Representative Girard, I think.
That was a compliment. Yeah.
Mr. Siebert, you had a question.
I just wanted to make sure I heard correctly for performance measurement number 6. Did you say the federal government's goal is to have all munitions done by 2012.
Mm-hmm. The Army thinks they'll be done by 2010, but they won't.
They won't be. Okay. Because I'm looking at the targets, and you know it's 39% by 2009, and if you're going to get to 100% by 2012, maybe we need to look at. And the actual data, for example, you said I think 25% of total munitions are already destroyed for 07. Mm-hmm. So we're basically already at the target for this year, mm-hmm. and it's just April.
Right.
So we can talk about maybe revising those to line up with the ultimate goal of being done by 2012.
Okay. We can talk about that, and we probably will talk about it since there was a recent court decision by Judge Marcus, which indicated that the last part of the stockpile, which is mustard gas, probably could use a different technology than incineration. And if that holds, this whole set of targets probably doesn't mean anything. And probably doesn't mean anything in terms of the international treaty either, because they have to build a whole new facility to process mustard gas.
Is that decision that you could use something else or that you should use something else other than incineration?
That decision is that we're supposed to go back and ruminate upon that, Senator Devlin, and decide whether or not they are, in fact, using best technology for mustard or whether, in fact, something else ought to be considered. So it opens the door to a debate that we had at the very beginning of this process when the permit was first issued.
The court has taken into consideration how long that process might take.
Mr. Devlin, I would not presume to speak for Judge Marcus, but I would guess that he probably has taken that into consideration.
Okay. Being mustard gas, I would presume that the munitions might be older than anyone in this room.
Senator Devlin, the mustard is in one-ton containers. It is not in weapons. And so that, interestingly enough, could open up the conversation about transport again, which is not allowed in the permit right now, but since it doesn't involve munitions, there may be some. The Army may push for that themselves. I don't know. I've not talked to this court decision just came out, so we haven't processed it yet.
Another question, slightly different area. The Department of Energy has a role relative to the Hanford cleanup. And the Hanford cleanup compared to Umatilla is kind of like there is no comparison, actually. But would you have a role when it's shown that the plumes that are coming from Hanford have actually contaminated the Columbia River?
Senator Devlin, yes, and the role actually is in the reverse. When we do, when we've had to do risk assessments associated with destroying the chemical weapons, then that those risk assessments have had to take into consideration cumulative impacts. And so presumably if another risk assessment has to be done, and I don't know yet because, as I said, we haven't really thoroughly reviewed what this court decision means, that we would factor in the Hanford as well in that risk assessment.
Don't take this wrongly, but I think it, you could make a comment on any cleanup that's occurring in the state that you're doing better than Hanford. Wouldn't be much of a positive statement. But
actually, Senator Hedlund, I was going to say the same thing myself, so I agree with you.
Okay. Any additional questions? Okay, we'll go on to 7 and 8.
Great. Key performance measure number 7, which is on page 9, supports DEQ's strategic priority of protecting people and the environment from toxics by cleaning up historic contamination. The measure tracks our progress in cleaning up sites that vary widely in size and complexity. The measure tracks separately cleanup of contamination from leaking underground petroleum storage tanks that are typically found at older gas station facilities and all other contaminated sites. These other hazardous substance sites include a broad range of contaminated sites, primarily former industrial sites with contaminants such as solvents or wood treating chemicals, but also large sites like Portland Harbor, which is a federal Superfund site. We met our 2005 target for identified hazardous waste sites cleaned up. This is despite the fact that in 2005 we added 2,000 sites to the list of sites that need attention. In 2006, we achieved the target of completing cleanups at 75% of all sites identified. This measure, I need to let you know, has been revised as a benchmark from the time that we reported on it in the 2005 Annual Performance Progress Report. So the data that you're looking at in this form looks different than what's contained in the report. What we've done is we've back calculated the results of our data using the new measure, so that's the data that you're looking at. But if you want to look at the old measure, you can turn to tab B in Appendix 1, and it's on page 25. We worked with the Oregon Progress Board to change this benchmark because we've been concerned that the measure as it was written didn't tell an accurate story about our performance. In the new measure, we've removed the words "or being cleaned up," which allows us to report more accurately on the environmental results achieved by tracking only completed cleanup. So we're no longer tracking sites that are undergoing current cleanup. We're just only tracking the ones that have been cleaned up completely. The revised benchmark changes the data that we'll report next year as well as the targets, which is why on this form you don't see past targets. DEQ's budget contains 5 land quality packages that support this measure. If we don't get the policy packages requested, it won't affect our ability to meet the targets in the near term, but would in the longer term. And key performance measure number 8, which is also on page 9. For this measure, we're focusing efforts on reducing and removing increased quantities of mercury from the environment to protect human health. A key strategy is to provide alternatives for proper management of mercury-containing products through public-private partnerships and household hazardous waste collection events. In 2005, we collected 296 pounds of mercury, which far exceeded the target of 125 pounds. A couple of special projects, including collections of mercury thermostats and thermometers used in the dairy industry, contributed to our success last year. In 2006, we collected 182 pounds of mercury, less than that collected in 2005, but primarily because of the successful completion of the dairy industry program. Our 2006 results exceeded the target by removing 150 pounds of mercury from the environment. That was our target. Any questions on either of these?
Thank you. I do on number 8 on the toxic prevention reduction PPM. And the question I have is, what elements are covered in the toxic use reduction program? And I can sort of off the top of my head, you know, remember a few, but I'm just curious how many elements are included, and then why we only have a KPM for mercury, and why not arsenic and lead and the other elements?
Sure. You can add. Representative Dingfelder, we're focusing right now on getting mercury out of the environment, so that really is the focus. We will be looking at how to incorporate our air quality program in terms of mercury emissions for this measure, but at this point, most of the work that's being done is through the land quality program, and it really is focusing on not only fostering these household collection events, but also setting up permanent collection facilities so that people will have an easier way to get rid of the mercury-containing products. And mercury is the focus right now.
But if I may add, Representative Dingfelder, there has been a persistent bioaccumulative toxics list that EPA generated, and I think there's discussion right now in this body of whether or not Oregon needs its own list. The concept behind the toxic reduction plan was to take elements one at a time, starting with mercury. And I'd have to get the rest of the list for you. It's probably the same as the EPA list. And we would just do projects related to mercury, and we'd move on to the next one, whether it's arsenic or whatever it is. And so that is the theory behind it. As Karen said, that we're focused on mercury, we're focused on these kinds of collection events. There's the question, of course, that our commission, for example, has made a decision recently about controlling mercury at the PGE Boardman plant, and we would presume that there would be some mercury reduction associated with that. The Willamette Water Quality Toxics TMDL. Ultimately, all of those things would contribute to reduction of mercury, but we have not tackled any of the other elements than mercury with a specific plan in the same way as we have one for mercury.
Follow-up question? Thank you, Stephanie. And the follow-up to that is, how does this translate percentage-wise? In other words, I would have to look at what your plan is to see if we're achieving 190, and I'm just trying to even see what the measure is.
These are pounds, Representative, yes.
So what, and I don't know if our goal is 100% reduction by a certain date, but how does this fit in percentage-wise to, the goals that we're setting as far as reducing emission mercury exposure for our population? And I don't know if you could add, a percentage, because it's hard for us to see without having the plan as part of this KPM where that fits in.
I think Representative Dingfelder and Karen may want to jump in here, that this measure is one that is ripe for conversation about whether or not we want to expand it to include percentages. It's, as you know, it's very, very difficult to do because mercury, for example, comes from other places. And so getting to 100% is certainly not realistic. But that's not to say there couldn't be a percentage reduction and that it couldn't be expanded to include specifically air and water. This is limited because it's easy to capture, it's easy to identify what you're doing, but we would certainly be open to having that conversation, and then obviously depending on what happens with legislation this session, that may affect this measure as well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good question.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
What is the fact that we're getting a lot of air contamination coming from Asia? Is mercury involved in that? What can you do about that?
Senator Nelson, that is absolutely a fact. It is absolutely true that much of the there is some mercury in natural background, but much of it is being deposed, for air deposition, coming from overseas. All the West Coast is subject to that, and there's probably nothing that we in Oregon can do except work with our congressional delegation in terms of whatever kinds of discussions are going on to help China with their pollution problems. And but it's very real, and it's one of the reasons it makes it so difficult to really identify a level of commitment that we can actually make some kind of a dent in it.
Thank you.
In terms of the amount of mercury being removed, do we have corresponding numbers for the amount of mercury that we introduce in the state? Do we know how much is being released?
Senator Devlin, that's a good question. I'll find out for you. Are you talking about in terms of product containing mercury? Or
products, the Boardman plant.
Or water.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, that sort of fits on my question about where, you know, are we achieving our goals for reduction, whether regardless of the source?
Well, if I may just comment a little bit more about that, we will give you the best information we can give you. I mean, one of the reasons we have a request in our budget for water quality toxics monitoring is that we can't tell you for a lot of toxics how much is in the water. We can tell you what permit limits are and how much people are allowed to discharge, but we are woefully inadequate in our ability to monitor for toxics. Better in air. We're better equipped in air than we are in water, but we simply don't have the data in some cases.
Just a comment on Senator Nelson. It's probably not affecting us, but I assume it's probably affecting Canada. I was flying back from the East Coast yesterday during the early hours of the evening, so it was still quite clear, and flying near the border of Kentucky and Tennessee. And on the border there it must have been a large coal-fired plant, and you could see the plume of it going north, and I assume it was going north through Kentucky into Indiana, and then probably on to Canada. So.
Well, Senator Devlin, not to digress too much, but the huge national debate on the air mercury rule was really centered around the Midwest and the Northeast United States, because there are a lot of coal-fired power plants in the Midwest, and, of course, the New England states and some in the Northeast were really taking issue with the air deposition of mercury that was coming from those plants. And so that federal rule was really about that.
We will do two more.
Okay. And then we'll okay. Key performance measure number 9 on page 10. This is an existing Oregon benchmark that measures the quantity of municipal solid waste that's landfilled or disposed. This measure supports our strategic priority of involving Oregonians in solving environmental problems as well as our environmental mission. We're proposing to adopt this benchmark as an agency key performance measure. There are several of these that are actually existing benchmarks that we want to adopt as key performance measures. In 2005, Oregonians disposed of 1,677 pounds of solid waste, exceeding our target of 1,631 pounds. Although Oregonians are recycling more, we are seeing an increase in the amount of solid waste that's being disposed. Construction, remodeling, and demolition waste contribute significantly to this increase. A key focus for DEQ's solid waste program in the coming years will be to develop and implement strategies to reverse this trend.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, if you're going to move on to the next measure, I'm going to have Greg Pettit take my place at the table. He is our laboratory administrator, and whenever you're ready to move to this measure, he's going to present this measure.
Why don't we do this? Representative Girard had to leave because the House Republicans are having a caucus now. The rest of my other House members actually have to be in session by 10. This might be a good place to break and see if there are any questions on number 9, the solid waste. Yes, Representative Dinkfelter.
Just be a nice day for questions. Besides the grammatical error in the goals, as far as the no apostrophe. Regarding, you know, I'm well aware and I've been following this, and you know I'm working on the computer recycling initiative, which hopefully we'll be hearing in this committee soon. But what efforts or what can we do, or recommendations do you have? I mean, you know, we are recycling more, however, we're generating more. And so certainly, and it doesn't have to be here, but at some point it would be very helpful, I think, for the legislative body to hear, and possibly the EQC has already heard that. What can we do to encourage, you know, reuse or, in essence, its reduction in generation, and what policies we have that either aren't working or that we need to think about improving? I mean, we've been focusing on the recycling end a lot, but not on the prevention end, I think, as much as we could. So it would be helpful, I think, as policymakers, to hear any recommendations that you have, as we are seeing an increase over time in actual generation rates. And I don't know if this is consistent nationwide, but something, if you've looked at other states, how we're doing comparatively, would be helpful as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, we'd be happy to do what we've done in Ways and Means sometimes is just a little memo that we do as a follow-up with some of that data. We'd be happy to provide you that on this subject. And any further conversation you'd want to have about it, that'd be fine, or in your policy committee as well.
Different kind of question in this. With this much waste being actually ultimately landfilled, and obviously the population increasing, so the...
Well, it's per capita, though.
Yeah, it's per capita, yeah. But with the population increasing, the amount of waste
right.
is increasing. I obviously know that the Portland metropolitan area with Arlington has enough capacity for at least probably her lifetime and probably even a little, quite a bit longer, depending upon. But are there areas in the state where they're running out of landfill capacity? I know landfills are so easy to site.
Mr. Chair, the we don't have very many of the large landfills left anymore. It's been a little while since I've looked at these data, but I think probably down the Medford area would be one of the first places where they would be challenged to run out of space. I'm not sure how Coffin Butte is doing. Of course, we're having a huge brouhaha out in Hillsboro now at the what they refer to now as the Lakeside Landfill, which used to be called something else when I did solid waste. But, of course, the communities have built up around them. I think probably what we're going to see is as much challenge from that as from running out of capacity, where people simply don't want these landfills where they are anymore. Now, I will say, though, that since Subtitle D came in a number of years ago, I mean, we went from 200 and some landfills down to 20 landfills. And basically the way we accommodated that is that a lot of these places were turned into transfer stations. So even when we do run out of capacity in a given location, alternatives will be found. I mean, it basically is going to mean transporting more garbage around. Whether or not it means siting any more big regional landfills remains to be seen. I mean, Southern Oregon being a good case in point, because I would suspect that they would be up against it. There's only two garbage burners in the state. I think there's still one in Coos Bay, and of course there's Brooks, Marion County. But my personal opinion about incineration is that you think siting a landfill is hard. Getting anybody to approve any kind of an incinerator for anything is, I think, next to impossible.
I have to leave it on this, is that I arrived at the Metro Council within months after their decision not to site an incinerator, and they requested actually a study be done of the long-term health impacts, which after they received the study, and the study being inconclusive, but saying what the potential could be for introduction of things into the atmosphere that had not been previously introduced. I don't think they would ever cite an incinerator under those circumstances. And it was just interesting to me that one of the most conservative members of the council basically made his judgment, which was a good judgment. He said he understood the impacts of landfills and the impacts of leachate and everything else from the landfills. He didn't understand the impacts from incineration, so he preferred to go with the known than the unknown. So,
Mr. Chair, before we close, just a clarification on the per capita disposal numbers that you have listed here. Is that for residential, industrial, and commercial waste? Is that a combination?
It's municipal solid waste.
Only. Okay.
So
that probably does.
It's not demolition debris.
Not demolition
debris. Okay.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. On the memo that you might prepare regarding sort of landfill or whatever, I wondered if there's any states doing anything around packaging of products, because it's unbelievable to me. Half of this stuff, it's worse than doing a Rubik's Cube. I can't even get into the thing. And it seems like it's getting worse. I would think it'd be getting better. Packaging is insane.
Representative Clem, we'll include that in the memo, but as Representative Dingfelder just indicated, there have been discussions on this issue.
Unreal.
Which isn't to say there shouldn't still be.
Yeah.
With that, we will start again tomorrow morning, and I'll close the public hearings and close the meeting.